Well, yes, as Sam says, this morning we're on to part two of our series on Colossians. And we're looking at what I think is one of the most amazing passages in the whole Bible. And unsurprisingly, as we've said, the subject is Jesus. Jesus is the one who reveals the glory of the Father. Jesus, the one who creates and sustains the universe. Jesus, the author of salvation. If you were here last week, you'll remember that we were thinking about the prayers that Paul prays for the Colossians. And one of the things he prays for them every time he prays for them is that they would know God and know his will. And in this wonderful passage that we have this morning, we see how we know God. So as we go this morning, can I encourage you just to bask in the greatness of Jesus? Let these truths wash over you. The first five verses that we have are quite poetic in nature. Some scholars actually even think it might have been an early Christian hymn that Paul's quoting here. But whatever the case, it describes what Jesus is like. And the first thing that it reveals to us is that he is the one who reveals God's glory. I heard a story recently about ex-footballer Kevin Keegan, who's on top of John Toshack, and here in this picture. John Toshack was Kevin Keegan's quite small, John Toshack's quite big, and they had this great partnership when they played together for Liverpool. And it was so good that people used to describe them as telepathic. And actually, some university somewhere thought there was maybe a little bit of traction in this. So they got Toshack and Keegan to come and they did a study on them. And the study was this. So they had a deck of cards and they each had to draw four cards. And then they looked at the card one at a time and the other person had to guess what was on the card. And the person who had the card in their hand had to sort of try and transfer it with their mind to them. And amazingly, John Toshack got them all right. But when it came to Kevin Keegan, he tried and he got them all wrong. So he said to John after, he said, I get it now. You're the telepathic one, not me. And John said, no, mate. I just saw the reflection of your cards in the camera lens behind your head. The first thing that Paul tells us about Jesus is this, verse 15, he is the image of the invisible God. The image of the invisible God. What does that mean? Well, the first thing to say is that Paul is not saying something invisible has a reflection. Invisible things don't have a reflection. Rather, he's saying something invisible is being made visible. In that sense, Jesus is a bit like that camera lens that revealed the cards. But Jesus shows us God, and obviously what he reveals about God is much more important. But what exactly does he reveal? Well, I like how Paul puts it when he writes to another church, a church in Corinth. And he says this to them. He said, for the God who said, let light shine out of darkness, has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. When we look at Jesus, we see God's glory. We see what he's like. We see his mercy and his grace, his love and his forgiveness, his justice and his righteousness. And what it makes it all the more remarkable is that it is impossible to look upon God in any other way. If you were to turn right back to near the start of your Bible, to Exodus, Moses is on Mount Sinai and he asks God, let me see your glory. And this is how God replies to him. He says, you cannot see my face, for man shall not see me and live. But there is a face we can now look at, and not just look at, but see a God who is otherwise unseeable. Jesus is the image of the invisible God. He reveals his glory. Then next it reveals that he's the creator of all things. Have you ever made anything from scratch? Last year for my birthday, my wife got me a cheese-making kit. And so far, I've only attempted making cheese once. I tried to make some mozzarella with limited success. Limited because it tasted and looked like cheese, but it did not taste or melt like mozzarella did. Having never made cheese before, though, I had absolutely no idea how precise the whole thing is, how involved you have to be in the process. You have to be very precise about temperatures. You have to be very precise about the amount of time you heat things for. And I didn't even realize you have to knead it like you knead dough for bread. Nothing is accidental in the cheese-making process. And doing it makes me wonder, how on earth did anyone work out how to do this in the first place? In these next few verses, Paul turns his attention to what Jesus makes, or rather what is made through him. It's the entire universe. But the first thing that he says is this. He says that Jesus is the firstborn of all creation. And it's easy for us to read this as Jesus has been created, that he was the first thing to be created. But that's not what the poem is saying. This term, firstborn, is used obviously with regard to birth, but it also carries with it a regal meaning. So today we often speak about people being leaders in their field, and we say that when they have revolutionized whatever their field is, if it's a medical field or something like that, or that they've shown an initiative in some way that sets them out from the rest. And that's the sort of idea here. Jesus stands out from creation, stands out from it because he's before it, because he's above it, because he has primacy like a king, supremacy like a king over it. And Paul goes on to explain why he has this supremacy. Verse 16. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. Here Paul tells us exactly what Jesus has created. Literally everything. Heaven, earth, visible things, invisible things, powers on earth, powers in the heavenly realms. There's nothing that exists that has not been brought into existence by Jesus. Everything exists because Jesus has decided it should. And following on from that, things are created for him, for his pleasure. And all of this means that nothing that exists is accidental. Everything is deliberate. Everything is a step that he has taken. Like me with the cheese, every step I took was deliberate. Although I did it deliberately, sometimes I made mistakes. But I made the cheese for my own pleasure as well, albeit limited success. Jesus has no such problem. Then comes another extraordinary statement, verse 17, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. One of the commentators I read this week says that he keeps the cosmos from becoming a chaos. But I think Jesus is more than that. Jesus is more than a cosmic elastic band that keeps everything together. He is intimately involved in every operation that happens in the universe. He's like the universe's motherboard. It's like how Paul quotes the Stoic philosophers in Acts 17. He says, about God. He says, in him we live and move and have our being. Jesus is not passive in creation, whether we realize it or not. The universe is utterly dependent upon him. In fact, it's the universe that would be utterly passive if it weren't for his active involvement in it. Jesus doesn't set the world in motion and walk away. He's not a divine clockmaker. He sets it in motion and he gets involved. Then next, he's the author of our salvation. And the first thing the poem says about Jesus' relationship to the church is that he is the head of the body, the church. And the picture of the church is a body of something that's used elsewhere by Paul. When he writes to the Corinthians, he uses it to emphasize their interdependence upon other Christians, on the diversity of gifts that exist within the church. But here the emphasis is on Jesus. And what does it mean for him to be the head? Well, apparently it was common at the time for philosophers to use the body as a metaphor for the universe. And since Paul has just spoken about the creation of it, he is subtly binding together the church and the universe. He is linking their destinies in the person of Jesus. More clearly, perhaps, the head raises a couple of other things for us. That like the head directs and governs the body, Christ directs and governs the church. But also this Greek word head also means source. Jesus is not only the leader of the church. He is the source of its life and its power. Then next we are told that he's the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. Paul deliberately uses this same word, firstborn, to further connect the fate of the universe and the fate of the church. Just as Jesus is supreme in creation, he is supreme in the church. And one day you will be acknowledged as such in the universe as he is in the church. Jesus is ushering in a new time by being the first to take on a new body. In him, then, the hope of glory enters time. His preeminence, his supremacy will be fully realized one day when every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus is Lord. So Jesus is the head of the church. He is the forerunner of the church. And next, he is the reconciler of the church. For in him, all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. This week, as I've been walking to and from church, I've been listening to a really interesting podcast about Hansie Cronje, who is the former South African cricket captain who resigned in disgrace for match fixing. And he was captain at a time when to be a South African sportsman was to be a statesman for the new South Africa emerging from apartheid, all of which made his fall from grace all the harder on the country. In the podcast, an interview with his brother was what particularly struck me. The interviewer asked him if it had been difficult for him to forgive his brother. And he sort of scoffed and he said, the difference between British journalists and South African journalists is that British ones don't understand why I have found it so easy to forgive my brother's misdemeanors. The South Africans, on the other hand, have any issue with it. And he put it down to the impact that this other gentleman in our picture had on the country, Nelson Mandela, and the Christian faith that is quite prevalent in the country. Mandela, of course, is famously imprisoned for nearly 30 years under apartheid and emerged from prison to become president and advocated peace and reconciliation between blacks and whites. Paul impresses upon us here that the fullness of God dwells in Jesus. Why does he do that? Well, in one sense, we would be right to say it. Well, it's because it's true. The fullness of God does dwell in Jesus. But it has more purpose than that. It's important that Jesus is God for what comes next. You see, Mandela was not perfect, of course, but he was well placed to lead a country to reconciliation, given the injustice he had experienced himself. But Jesus is not just best placed to reconcile, he is the only one who can fill this infinite chasm that there is between man and God. Only God can fill it. And he does it with sacrifice, he does it by shedding his own blood, he does it by giving his life. This poem also shows us why such an incredible sacrifice is required. Just flick back to it. Often when the cross is considered, we think about it only in reference to its impact on humanity. And look, its impact on humanity is huge. But this poem magnifies our view. All things, it says, all things are reconciled. Everything in earth and in heaven are reconciled through Jesus, which amplifies to us, doesn't it, the power that the cross has, but it also amplifies to us the problem that required such a response. Paul reminds us, verse 21, "And you who once were alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds." It's my fault. It's not the easiest thing to say, is it? Especially when it's true. We're very good at pointing the finger at other people. We might be tempted to point the finger at God for this chasm that exists. But Paul reminds us here that it's our fault. We are alienated. We are hostile in mind. We were doing evil deeds. God would be utterly justified in walking away. But what's remarkable is instead of walking away, he has run to us in Jesus. As he said at the start, last week we saw how Paul prayed. He prayed every single time. He prayed for the Colossians that they would know God and know his will. Here he shows us how. We know him by looking full in the face of Jesus. He is the one who reveals the glory of God to us. He is the one who has created all things for his pleasure and sustains it by his active involvement in it. He is the one who shows us God's incredible love and grace in filling this infinite chasm that exists between man and God by making peace at great cost, the cost of his own life. There's no doubt that because God is infinite and all-powerful, that he's omnipresent, that he's everywhere, that God is complex and too complex, actually, for us to fully grasp and understand. But because of that, there are aspects of our faith which are complicated. There are aspects of our faith that are a mystery to us. But at the heart of living out our faith is something very simple. Look to Jesus. Look to Jesus. Keep your eyes on him. In the rest of this book, as we shall see in the coming weeks, we see what an impact doing that has on our lives. It's the key for persevering through suffering. It's the key to dealing with the vast majority of false teaching. It's how our lives are transformed. It's how our relationships with others are transformed. But for now, let's just bask in the wonderful, marvelous Jesus that we've been singing about. Let him wash over us. And look, if you're here this morning and you don't know Jesus, you don't have a faith in him, this little poem shouts at us, why not? This is the God that we can know. This is the God that we can trust in today. But before we close, I just want to look at that last verse, which shows us our role. It says, if indeed you continue in the faith, stable and steadfast, not shifting from the hope of the gospel that you heard, which has been proclaimed in all creation under heaven. Our role is to dig in, to dig into the solid rock that is Jesus, to cling to him, to cling to the hope that he gives of life everlasting with him in perfection. God has done extraordinary things for us in the person of Jesus. Our role is to cling to him. To cling to him and no one else. We're going to sing again, and we're going to sing again about what he's done for us. I'm going to sing, oh, praise the name. So shall we stand together?